And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin on this Wednesday, September 21st. As usual, I am with Arpin Basu. And Arpin, today, main camp is opening up with the medicals. How excited are you for the upcoming season?
I'm excited. It's going to be an interesting season that's not, how often do you have training camp start with management and the coach basically admitting that winning games is not the number one priority? So it's kind of a, from the get-go, you understand there are all sorts of other things going on with this team besides winning games. And yeah. I think everyone would like to win games, but it's not the number one priority. So we're going to get into that. We're going to get into training camp. A few of the things that are intriguing us that we should monitor over the next couple of weeks. We're going to go back over my trip to Buffalo and the prospect showcase or the rookie tournament. Some of my thoughts and kind of banter a little bit about some of the younger players. And then we're going to finish up, obviously, on Tuesday. PK Subban announced his retirement from the NHL at the age of 33. Surely looking to go on to do a multitude of other things in his career. Yeah. So we're actually instead of looking back on kind of the best PK moments, we thought it would be fun to discuss with you guys or discuss with each other and have you guys listen on just the uniqueness of covering PK Subban as a reporter and some of the stories that came up in our coverage of this very, very, very unique player, exciting, electrifying player, and really one of the probably the most entertaining player to watch that I've covered. Very close to Alex Kovalev is up there, but I think PK kind of tops out. But let's start with training camp.
Well, let's start with rookie camp, because I mean, you came back from Buffalo. You saw the kids at work. I think there's something that was obvious right from development camp in the summer, is that the level of in-house talent has been raised compared to previous years. And I think that it showed in Buffalo, because you've got guys that could, you got half a dozen legitimate future NHLers in the bunch. Some could be impact players. I'm thinking guy like Caden Gooley, for example. Obviously, Slafkovský. But there's quite a few guys that you say, yeah, this I could easily see that guy in the NHL one day. And I think it bodes well for the future, because it's always good to see, we've always hear management from different teams say, oh, well, you have to build through the draft and all that. But yeah, you have to pick the right players. You got the development well, develop them well. And for a team that said that they would build through the draft for so long, there you had very, very little to seek your teeth in for the past few years. But finally, I feel as though there's something very encouraging when it comes to the prospects of this team. So, well, you were there in Buffalo. If I could just start by asking you, who stood out the most among those guys?
Well, it's kind of a, you know, that question is, who stood out the most? Juraj Slafkovský stood out the most. But you expected Juraj Slafkovský to stand out the most. So because of those expectations, maybe some feel he didn't stand out the most. But if you looked at it objectively and you looked at all the players on the ice and just said, okay, if you took them all on the equal footing, had no idea where anyone was drafted, had no idea how much experience everyone had, had no idea how old everyone was, you would look at 18-year-old Juraj Slafkovský and say that guy stands out the most, not only in the Canadians group, but in every other group. Mm-hmm. I admittedly did not watch the Bruins or the Penguins, but they are two of the weaker pipeline teams in the NHL. I can't imagine they had players who would have stood out more than Juraj Slafkovský. He stood out the most. However, a standout also kind of implies who surprised you the most, who exceeded expectations the most. And
right.
to that extent, it is clearly Owen Beck, in my mind. You know, Owen Beck, when he was drafted, you know, and even the Canadians, you know, Martin Lapointe referred to him as being, these are players that you win with. You know, these are players you need on a winning team. Is Owen Beck is an example of that. Good faceoff guy, 200-foot game. Centerman, not blazing fast, not tons of offensive upside. Good, solid, two-way centerman, you know, which is fits the description of someone they passed on at number one overall in Shane Wright. So, you know, when I saw them take Owen Beck, I was like, this is them, you know, on top of trading for Kirby Dach, this is them compensating for the fact they did not take Shane Wright. They're getting Shane Wright light, if you will.
Yeah.
But seemingly without the same degree of offensive skill. Owen Beck showed up at that camp and that tournament, intent on showing that he's not devoid of offensive skill. And he showed that. He was dynamic. He drove play. He was always around the puck. He was getting chances. He was creating chances, smart decisions with the puck. You know, everything that he was advertised for, he did. But with just a little bit more offensive upside than I think I expected, at least personally speaking. So, biggest standout, Juraj Slafkovský, bar none, easy answer for me. But, you know, in relation to expectations, I think it was Owen Beck.
Yeah. Owen Beck was scouted at the junior level by Tyler Toffoli's dad with the Mississauga Steelheads. And Mr. Toffoli has raving reviews for Owen Beck, loves that player, and he was really excited that he was drafted by Montreal. It's because there seems to be – he's got a style of play where that seems so easily translatable to the NHL. And Toffoli, Mr. Toffoli told me, he said he's going to be 100% an NHL player. He might not dominate, but he's going to be a solid NHLer because of all the things that he does right in the game. And you mentioned the fact he might not be the fastest guy, but he's a good transition guy.
Yes.
And to that extent, would you see him as one day as a potential sort of Philippe Dano type of replacement or type of player?
Well, I mean, he was asked who his models were in the NHL. The first game he mentioned was Phil Dano. So it's, you know, and I think at the faceoff circle, and this, you know, if anyone didn't catch my notebook out of Buffalo, this summer he picked up the skill of switching hands on faceoffs and became quite adept at it, at least at this tournament. He took a number of draws left-handed on the left side, which you have the advantage of having the curve of the stick working with you instead of against you on your backhand. And he won a number of defensive zone draws on his weak side, making it not his weak side, just switching hands and going backhand. So that was interesting. And that's something apparently a lot of, maybe not a lot, but a non-negligible number of young players are doing these days is I think Thomas Bortolo is another one, the San Jose prospect out of Michigan. And, you know, Paul Gostad is actually the guy who kind of pioneered this. A lot of the guys around the Canadians, I kind of mentioned it to Alex Burrows, instantly mentioned Paul Gostad, Marty St. Louis, same deal. Paul Gostad used to do that. So he was the guy who kind of, I don't want to say invented it, but I guess thought of it first.
Right.
But not that many guys do it, but Owen Beck learned it from Jan Michak, who said he picked it up from perhaps Pierre-Édouard Bellemare, but he picked it up watching an NHL game, started doing it in OHL games. Owen Beck saw that, decided to do it himself. So maybe this will be the start of a trend, but that was interesting. But besides that, and you know, it's part of his face-off game, which is a part of his value. But yeah, he showed a lot. But otherwise, in terms of exceeding expectations, there were, you know, I think William Trudeau had an excellent few days, really showed himself as being someone. And listen, I think, because you got to remember, for a lot of these guys, this is management's first real look at them in a competitive environment. And William Trudeau's case is interesting because he would be eligible to play in the AHL if the Canadians decide to sign him either to an AHL contract or to a professional tryout arrangement, or he could go back to junior. He's in a unique position in that sense. And if he continues playing the way he played in Buffalo, he could play his way into the mix in Laval. The debate, obviously, is do you want him playing 12 to 16 minutes in Laval, or do you want him playing 30 minutes a night in Charlottetown? And apparently there's some rumblings that he will be traded to Blainville at some point. But do you want him dominating and playing massive minutes in junior and just having one last junior season? I think this would be his fourth, if I'm not mistaken. To kind of dominate. So this is like the age old development question. Do you get better practicing with better players and maybe not playing as much? Or do you get better being the dominant force in your league and getting all the minutes you can handle? I don't know the answer to that question, but William Trudeau played himself into the Canadians needing to answer that question. So if he continues in training camp, if he shows he can play with professionals and how he handles himself against men, could be a determining factor in what the Canadians decide to do with him.
Yeah, it's interesting because on Tuesday, we spoke to Rob Ramage and to Francis Bouillon and in separate interviews, and they both brought up William Trudeau and Xavier Simoneau as two guys that really stood out during rookie camp.
Yeah.
So Trudeau, yeah, I mean, he's turning 20 years old on October 11th. I think it's an interesting dilemma for them. But, I mean, considering all the young players, the logjam that we could expect in Laval, I mean, there's nothing wrong with him going back to juniors at this point, considering that he's going to turn 20, but it's not going to be like an overage, like the typical 20-year-old season, because he's a late birthday. But having him dominate and play a lot, there's no rush with a guy like that. You know, you can, a defenseman like that could simmer in the minors until he's 23, you know, before he's ready to play in the NHL anyway, if he will ever be. So, I mean, to wonder, do we precipitate, you know, giving him a spot in the AHL when he's barely turned 20? I don't really see the rush there. There's a progression is the interesting aspect there, you know.
Yeah, there's no rush. It's going to be a development question. Is will he develop, because he was pretty dominant in Charlottetown last season. You know, he had a very good season. So at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, does this guy have anything left to learn at that level?
Yeah.
It's something that the Canadians need to determine. I'm not saying he doesn't have anything to learn at the junior level, but at a certain point, you reach a saturation point where you're not gaining anything by playing at that level anymore. So the Canadians need to make that determination. And just to pick up on Simoneau, I agree. He was involved in everything. When he was on the ice, you noticed him. Even though he's the smallest guy on the ice, he made sure you noticed him because he got in there. He was not afraid of any battle situation. If there was a scrum in front of the net, the guy at the bottom of the pile was Cimino. It was time after time after time, game after game after game, where he was involved in. And he is, you know, this to me is a big part of Trevor Timmins' kind of legacy with this franchise, because this year, you know, when they took Raphael Harvey-Pinard in the seventh round in 2019, just to avoid having him sign as an undrafted free agent with another team, just to secure his rights, you know, they kind of created a bit of a tradition. They didn't really make a pick like that in 2020, but then in 2021, they took Cimino in the sixth round. And then this year, they took Miguel Tourigny in the seventh round. Right. And I thought Tourigny, as the tournament went on, improved. And his last game was by far his best. And he actually, you know, made an impact out there and showed the skill set that made him such a prolific scorer at the junior level, not just in the Quebec League, but on a national basis. He was one of the most prolific defensemen in the country. So, you know, it's just these interesting little risks on undersized local kids that the Canadians should continue taking. I mean, I don't know if Xavier Simoneau is ever going to play in the NHL. He probably won't, like, to be honest. But he's going to give himself a chance. Like, that's the way he plays the game. He gets noticed. And he'll give himself a chance and he'll play AHL games at some point. And if that's how he approaches them, then yeah, maybe he will be a guy who gets a call up now and then, or maybe even works his way onto an AHL roster. It's not likely. Again, like, it's even Raphael Harvey-Pinard, as well as he's done in Laval, the chances of him becoming a regular NHL player are pretty slim. But even if he becomes a spot NHL player, or, you know, or he becomes like kind of, he plays on a fourth line for a couple of years, that's a win for the Canadians. For a seventh round draft pick to play NHL games is a win. And if Xavier Simoneau becomes that 3, 4, maybe even 5 years down the road, that will also be a win. But he deserves a lot of credit. Like, he, you know, I mean, he said, like, halfway through the tournament, he said, "I told you guys, I'm not here as a tourist." It's like, flat out, je suis pas là comme touriste. And so it was like, and he wasn't, you know, and he really took the bull by the horns and he made sure that he got noticed. And I don't think he played a single shift where he was not noticeable throughout that tournament.
Right. Another thing regarding Buffalo, regarding the rookie camp, is the fact that, you know, you have Slafkovský on the ice, you've got Caden Gooley on the ice. Big Arbor Jakai on the ice, who looks like he's going to be the second coming of Radko Gudas. There's all of a sudden it looks
Canadians,
as though
the Canadians love him, by the way. Every single member of that organization loves him. There was one time when Arbor, when he, you know, he just destroyed some kid, not one of the guys that got hurt against Ottawa, some other guy. And, you know, the assistant coaches were on, and they just started to laugh. Like, it just became comical to a certain extent how he shouldn't be playing. He's a man among boys, quite literally. You know, I mean, he's an older guy. He's not young. He's not young in that context of a rookie tournament. He was one of the older players there. He's just destroying people left and right, and doing it with a little grin on his face and enjoying it. So it's, Arbor Jakai is someone that the entire organization is very enamored with, and it's noteworthy because this management team did not sign this guy. This is a Marc Bergevin signing, and a Marc Bergevin and Trevor Timmins and scouting staff discovery. So,
well, actually, the thing is, professionally, a lot of teams were after Jakai, and the Canadians were really happy to be able to be the ones that would sign the kid, because it seems as though many NHL teams were trying to do what the Canadians just did. So kudos to them. But my point was that with Slafkovský, with Gooley, with Jakai, you look at guys that they traded for, you know, since new management has come in, like Emil Heinemann, they signed out of college, they signed a guy named Lucas Condotta. There are bigger bodies there. So it's interesting to see how, on the one hand, they'll develop those, you know, those undersized local prospects that are long shots to make the NHL, but still it's worth giving them a chance. They're able to draft undersized defenseman like Lane Hutson, because on the other side, you've got much bigger guys that are coming in the pipeline and that are bringing that balance that, once again, that was lacking for so long. Because, there's a lot of discussion that's been done regarding the fact that Slafkovský's player profile is so hard to find. He's a bit of a unicorn in that sense. But even a guy like Jacky, the Canadians, when's the last time that the Canadians had a guy like that on their roster? You know, he's their...
Yeah,
was it Lyle Oderline the last time? I mean,
I think there's a bit of Sherratt in him, you know? I mean, there's a little bit of that. I think he's same question marks about him, mobility and what have you. And Jacky, you know, I asked him if he worked with a skills coach, you know, because I wanted to talk to that skills coach, but he said, well, there's not one in particular. Just whenever there's a skate in the Hamilton area, I just go to it. So whenever there's a skills coach working with pro guys in Hamilton, chances are you'll find Arbor Jacky on the ice there with whichever skills coach it is. So, you know, it's something he's working on. I think his footwork, he's never going to be the speediest defenseman, but I find his footwork to actually be pretty impressive and advanced. His pivots, you know, the way he turns back to retrieve pucks, or he turns to cut a guy off or to close a lane, I think is not a strength, but I wouldn't consider it a weakness necessarily.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You wrote a notebook, towards the end of rookie camp that was published in The Athletic, in which you had a public disclaimer or a public service announcement not to take too much out of that rookie camp and not to draw too quick a conclusion. But with that being said, is there someone that made you, that was a cause of concern based on his play, based on his behavior, that you thought, wait a minute, this, you know, it could have been better on this side?
Yeah, I mean, the one that jumps out is Riley Kidney. You know, as I mentioned in the notebook for anyone who read it, but if you haven't, it's, you know, he didn't have the best weekend. Again, it's not the end of the world. He might show up at training camp and be great, just like he was a year ago. I thought Riley Kidney was really impressive in his first professional training camp. Then went out and had a fantastic season in the Q, and then came into this and just kind of wasn't firing on all cylinders. Just didn't seem to have the jump necessary, didn't have the energy, wasn't really making too many plays. I mean, last year, you know, his decision making was very on point. He was playing a fearless game. He was putting himself into dangerous situations without thinking twice about it. That wasn't the same guy this year. Now, who knows what kind of circumstances he was dealing with, but he was not fantastic. The other guy is Justin Barron. And for guys like Justin Barron, who have a fair amount of professional experience and have expectations to play on the big club this year, an event like this is a lose-lose. Like, if you dominate the tournament, well, yeah, you should dominate the tournament. You're an NHL caliber defenseman. If you don't dominate, if you just kind of play okay, which is, I think, how Justin Barron played, then everyone's eyebrows are raised and like, oh, why didn't you dominate? You know, like the bar for guys like that is dominate. And that's tough to go into any situation where you're expected to dominate. So, and you know, Slafkovský had that same expectation of himself, and I don't think it would be fair to say he dominated. He didn't. You know, he had the one assist in two games, but I still think he showed more of himself, his style of play, his priorities, his willingness to make plays, to be a playmaker, constantly looking for Philip Mechar in the first game, and just generally looking to set teammates up and use the attention that he was drawing, which I didn't think was a big part of his toolkit. It's a bigger part than I thought, and I even thought he overpassed at times. But in Barron's case, you know, he was fine, no more than that. And so let's see how that translates into training camp. I mean, as someone, you know, as one person I talked to in the Canadian, sometimes guys need a bit of a wake up call, and an event like this can be good for that. It's not all that important. It's just a rookie tournament, but it gives certain guys a little kick in the ass. Like, okay, that didn't go as planned. Mm-hmm. Now the main camp is starting. I need to address that. I need to respond, and I need to show that that's not who I was. So I'll be very interested to see how Barron does that in this camp.
Yeah, because he's not in a position where he can be complacent. I mean, he's a right-handed defenseman. It's a rarity right now on the Canadiens' blue line, and in that sense, he might have the inside track for a job in Montreal. But at the same time, there are other guys that are able to play on their offside. So, I mean, I asked that question to Francis Bouillon yesterday, and he pointed out that Jordan Harris and Arber Chaka are two guys that could be very comfortable playing on the right side, even though they're lefties. Yeah.
Corey Schoeneman's in that mix as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Joel Edmondson also, who could play, if need be, on the right side. There are the Canadiens have options.
Yeah,
and they will definitely be on the lookout for waivers and see if there's an option that's available to them on waivers towards the end of training camp when teams start making the tougher cuts. There are some organizations that have already been targeted by the Canadiens as teams that have an abundance of defensemen that are poised to make one available through waivers. So look out for the Canadiens if they might jump on one of those guys. And if they do that, if Justin Barron has not been convincing enough, then he could very well start in Laval instead of the NHL if they decide to bring some more experience. But yeah, you wanted to add something?
Well, no, but I think that's a good way to transition into the main camp is that all these guys, I mean, listen, the Canadiens have like a football training camp roster. There's 74 people on the list.
That's insane. That's a lot of guys. I don't understand.
I don't understand.
They got four teams. That's four teams.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of people are going to get a look, and I think just about everyone who's at rookie camp has been invited to the main camp. So, it's kind of symbolic in a way, though, because it does kind of reflect the Canadian situation up front in terms of, you know, the sheer number of NHL forwards they have. Like, you invite all these guys, and there's literally no jobs to be had at forward. I mean, the Canadians can say what they want, like, oh, we're going to let it play out. It's going to be on merit. We're going to make decisions based on that. No. Forward-wise, no one's making the team. Whoever's there, the 16 forwards that they have, those are the forwards. So if you're in camp as a forward, show well, create an impression, put something in the back of people's minds for down the road, but you better be ready for getting that call where, you know, your training camp's over, you're going back to either the AHL or junior or wherever you came from. So, pretty unique situation as far as a team that's coming off the last place overall finish, a team with the first pick overall on their training camp roster at the very least, and no jobs. No jobs available at forward. Yeah, just no jobs. Just all sorts of battles for ice time and roles. And so, you know, I mean, listen, let's start with sort of the newsy bit of the training camp roster being released. You know, Paul Byron, along with Logan Mailloux and Carey Price, obviously, find themselves on the injured list. Jonathan Drouin and Sean Monahan are not on the injured list. So, Paul Byron seems to be sort of a pivotal piece in terms of this roster puzzle that the Canadians need to figure out. How do you see this playing out for Paul Byron? Because the one thing with Paul Byron is he's already cleared waivers multiple times because he's got a big dollar figure attached to him. But yeah, he's in the last year of his contract. Does he become more of an appetizing waiver pickup for a team that has no cap space issues, could use a veteran type of forward? Like, do you think there's a possibility that if Paul Byron somehow gets, if he winds up on waivers at some point, that he might get picked up this year as opposed to other years?
That's a good question. I doubt it because, I mean, for his salary, even though he's in the last year of his contract, I'm sure that there will be other players that are more interesting at that price tag than Paul Byron, because there's so much risk, health risks involved with this player at this point in his career. I mean, I understand the leadership aspect, the fact that he's a proven veteran who gives it all and whatnot. But when you look, I mean, he's not as fast as he once was. He used to be a very surgical shooter who would certainly not be a volume shooter, but he used to run those crazy high shooting percentages and score a lot of goals based on the moment that he would choose to shoot the puck. This has not translated into effective numbers when he's been healthy enough to play in the last few years. So his level of effectiveness has gone down. I'd be surprised if he was picked up. But at the same time, I mean, the fact that he's starting camp on the injured list. I mean, today we're recording this podcast on Wednesday morning. The Canadians are doing their physicals as we speak. And yesterday, GM Kent Hughes was on on the radio with a broadcaster and was saying, well, from one week to another, we get good news and then not so good news regarding Paul Byron. The situation is murky when it comes to him. So they're looking to get some more answers probably today or in the coming days as to how it's going to play out for him. Is he going to be able to start the season on time? Is he going to miss a couple of weeks? Will it be more because of that murky situation? I think this is something that needs to set itself out to solve itself in time for season. But you were right to point out that with Drouin and Monahan being listed as healthy players to start camp, that's a significant development, and that certainly won't make decisions easier for the Canadians, because whether you put Byron in the balance or not, there's still a lot of forwards at that camp.
Yeah, Byron being injured. So let's take it for granted that Byron, because honestly, if Byron is the slightest bit uncomfortable, I think he's going to start the season on injured reserve. I mean, not long-term injured reserve, but just injured reserve. So
they're going to tell him you're injured.
Yeah, you're not quite ready yet, Paul. Look, yeah, give your, exactly. I think you're going to need a couple of weeks, because I think the Canadians are going to need a couple of weeks to figure out what they're going to do here. Because even without him, if both Drouin and Monahan are ready to start the season, that means they have 15 NHL forwards. You know, I think there's some reticence from the Canadians about putting Michael Pezzetta on waivers, because at the minimum salary, he could be an attractive piece for someone. Are you willing to put Joel Armia on waivers? Mike Hoffman on waiver? Like, I mean, you know, and are you willing to send them down?
I could easily see Joel Armia on waivers. Easily.
So could I. And so, because he's not going to get picked up. Like, there's no one is taking that contract. No one's taking Mike Hoffman's contract either. As long as it's properly communicated to them, this is why we're doing this. It's a possibility, but these are all short-term Band-Aid fix, right? I mean, They need, this is going to be weird to say, but like they need some people to get injured for them to be able to manage this situation, or they need to make a trade. And so
I think they count on that. The injuries, I mean, the number of times that
Kent Hughes they're not counting on it. It's just the reality. No, okay. It's the reality.
I know. It's not that it's, of course, they're not counting on it because you never wish ill on your own players. But what I mean by that is that they see, well, every year, you know, guys get injured. We've had COVID the past couple of years. You need a lot of bodies. That's part of the discourse from the GM that we've heard, you know, for the past few months. This is just, as you say, this is just a reality. This is an acknowledgement of the fact that, you know, the ideal roster that you put out on paper and the 23 guys that start the season for you are not necessarily the 23 guys that you're going to carry the whole year because injuries happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. But, you know, I mean, there's depth and then there's, you know, cumbersome depth. And that's kind of what the Canadians have it for right now. They have cumbersome depth in the sense that they have a lot of veterans on big contracts, some of whom they have, it is in the Canadians' best interest to have them perform. So Drouin and Monahan are right there on that list, along with Evgeny Dodonov. So I thought, you know, just quickly here, maybe spitball what you envision some of the forward combinations looking like. This might make us look very stupid very quickly, but how would you, if you were coach, how would you organize these forwards?
Okay, so that's my bold predictions for camp before camp starts. Let's say that Byron starts on the injured list. So let's scratch him off for now. I'm going to go, even though I probably said the opposite earlier, let's put Slafkovský and Laval to start the year.
Whoa.
Because of this idea that he can easily be called up as soon as there is an injury, that he can start there and be called up and stay in Montreal afterward. I'd like just to, yeah, it's a bold decision, but hear me out. So no doubt that Suzuki is your first line center. I think that it'd be interesting if Caulfield and Suzuki, you could split them up and put them on different lines and have spread the wealth a little bit, spread it around, because as many bodies as you have, I think that it will be important that you've got like significant firepower and young firepower coming from many different places. So I would have Anderson, Suzuki, Gallagher. Guys, a lot of guys playing on their off wings. That's something that Martin Saint-Louis likes. So I would put Anderson on the left side, give it a shot, big guy. Yeah, Anderson, Suzuki, Gallagher. Then I would have Caulfield, Doc, and Monahan. I know that Evans is, if he's the guy that he's, you know, the fifth center, he could be put on the wing to help out Doc, but at the same time, I think that Monahan being eased back into the lineup following his injury could help out also at the faceoff circle with Doc, provide more offense. He's played some wing before. So Caulfield, Doc, and Monahan seems like a very... It gives both Doc and Monahan a decent chance at having good seasons. Then I would have Drouin, Dvorak, and Dodonov. And I would round that up with Hoffman, Evans, and Pitlick, which would put Armia on the sideline, possibly Pezzetta on the sideline, and one or both of them as potential waiver wire candidates. So that's... I might have... You know, I might have, you know, by putting Slafkovský in Laval, it sort of solves a problem. And I know that they're going to give him an extended look and that their intention is to keep him in Montreal. So I think that's one. We'll see how training camp plays out. But if you look at the current group, of veterans and the guys that are, you know, like regular NHLers. This is how I would see it.
Okay.
And I know that
that's your prerogative.
Yeah. And I know that yours is going to be so different than mine. And that's what I wanted. That's why.
Yeah, yeah. Yours. Yeah. Mine, well, I don't think. I think you're there. I would be stunned if your Slavkovsky began the season in Laval. I really would. Not only, you know, he would have to be so incredibly awful in training camp, because I think the Canadians want to see him play against NHL competition as soon as possible, just from an evaluation standpoint. I'm not saying he'll never be in Laval. I would be shocked if he began the season in Laval. And I understand the waiver being waiver exempt makes it a very convenient thing for them to do. But Ken Hughes has promised that that will not be a factor in this decision. So I'm going to take him on his word. And one thing I know that Ken Hughes is sensitive to is the perception of his players, young players when they get demoted, that no matter what the team says, they think they did something wrong. And I don't think that's where they want to get off on that foot with this player. So Juraj Slafkovský is on my roster and he's playing with Nick Suzuki and Cole Caulfield.
Okay.
That's how I would do it. I don't know how they're going to do it, but that's how I would do it. Again, you don't want to coddle a player. But when you take a player first overall, when you have so much belief in that player, and when this player, before he's even drafted, is talking about how he'd be a great fit with Suzuki and Caulfield, I think it's worth checking out, you know, and it's worth giving him that little, okay, you think you'd be a good fit with these guys? Well, go show us how good a fit you can be. So I would do that. Then the rest of my lineup would really be based on trying to get the most out of the guys that I plan on trading. And so what I would do is I would put all three deadline guys, Drouin, Monahan, and Dadonov, on the same line and see what they can do. So this would be the rental team. This would be all rental line, I should say. The rental line. Maybe that could be their nickname if that actually happened. So
they would love it.
I'm sure they would love it. Yeah, I'm sure they would love it. The rental line. So that would be Drouin, Monahan, Dadonov. I like the idea of having Anderson and Gallagher together. Gallagher tried left wing when Marty St. Louis took over. It didn't last very long. I have a feeling it wouldn't last very long with Anderson either, but I also would be willing to give it a try. And I'd put those two guys with Kirby Doc. Give them a chance to rub off on Doc a little bit. If there's one area of Doc's game that needs some work, it's the area of the game where Josh Anderson and Brendan Gallagher are very good at, which is being engaged on the forecheck and being active puck retrievers. And Doc's a pretty good playmaker. And both those guys, more Anderson than Gallagher probably, but both those guys could skate with Doc. So I think that would be a third line or 1C, if you will, or maybe 2B, I would call it.
And Gallagher would benefit from having a sentiment who carries the puck in a neutral zone with speed.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I would finish it up with Hoffman, Dvorak, and Evans.
Okay.
So Pitlick and Armia would be my guys, and Pizzetta.
Right.
Would be, so one of those three would have to be going on waivers. If it were me, it would be Pizzetta. If he gets picked up, then good for him. He goes to a situation where he can play. I know Ken Hughes would bust out in hives, losing an asset for nothing, but I would rather do that than potentially create this bad first impression for Juraj Slafkovský. So that's how I would do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that when you say Caulfield, Suzuki, Slafkovský, it's almost what's expected from day one. You know, it's more.
And the reason I would do it is because it's expected by the kid.
Yeah.
So I want to embrace that. I want to be like, okay, I like that. You know, you were at the combine. He was talking about playing with Suzuki and Caulfield. Like,
yeah, he made it as a good argument for the Canadians to draft him.
Exactly. So, all right, if you think that's going to work, then let's see it, kind of thing, and sort of challenge him a little bit. And I think it's also a good stylistic fit with those two guys. I feel having a big body who one thing in Buffalo, getting in on the forecheck and puck recovery in the offensive zone. This guy does that. He competes. Right. He competes, and he gets on his horse in the neutral zone. And if a puck is dumped in, he is on it like a dog on a bone. Like, so I would like to see that with those two guys. It's an element that those two guys could use. I think that's why Josh Anderson was given such a long look with those two guys, because that's something that he's also able to do. So I would be interested to see him. The one thing is that, you know, Slafkovský's pretty much been a left winger his whole life.
So Marty, that would involve keeping Caulfield
on the right side, and Marty, yeah, you know, Marty St. Louis liked having Caulfield on the left. So that's the only sort of adjustment that would be needed, but I think it would work.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly plausible. That's probably more likely than mine. But I started by saying that it was a bold prediction, and I wanted to. And I sort of expected that you would come up with the sort of lineup that you did. So if I had gone second, it would have created a better effect.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's well, wait, you guys can, you know, if you're listening to this on the Athletic app, you can leave comments. So if you want to comment on which line combinations you think are better, then feel free to do that. I'd be interested.
Or give us yours.
Give us yours in the comments as well. Absolutely. We'd be great. We'd be glad to hear them.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next, you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Listen, we're kind of running short on time here. We did want to talk about PK Subban's retirement at age 33. The expiry of that highly contentious 8-year, $72 million deal that he signed with the Canadiens after having gone to arbitration with the Canadiens turned out to be the last contract he ever signed in the NHL. Obviously, stories about PK Subban, his time in Montreal, have been saturating sort of the airwaves and print and everything. And both Marc-Antoine and I wrote about PK on Tuesday evening. You can read that on The Athletic right now, but we wanted to sort of give sort of our perspective, the media's perspective, on what it was like to cover this guy, because he was a whirlwind, you know. Well, let's start with you, Marc-Antoine. Like, just how would you describe the uniqueness of having PK Subban on the team that you cover, and how it could shape or influence your coverage plan on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I loved covering PK Subban. There is no doubt about it. It was a treat to see him at practice, how he would annoy his teammates and be constantly like this ball of energy all over the ice and picking up pucks and always being active. It felt good to see him. It was fascinating. He was a very engaging person. I think that the fans quickly took a liking to him and fell in love with the kid because of how charismatic he was, his big smile. And he was the same with us. I think that he was a very open and engaging person. So in that sense, it was really interesting to cover. Over time, you would learn a couple of things, though, that he could talk a lot and really not say much. But he would be exuberant in not saying anything. And he's one of those guys that would often say, "I'll be honest with you." And whenever he said, "I'll be honest with you," this was when the red light would turn on, like, oh, I'm about to be bullshitted.
Yes. And it was also, but I mean, the more you got to know his patterns, like one thing about PK is that he never stopped to think about his answer. He would just start talking. And then it would take him some time. Like he would think as he talked.
Yeah.
And so the first few sentences didn't really mean anything. That was him coming up with, what do I actually think about this question that was asked of me? And eventually he would get there. Now, sometimes he didn't. And you had to guide him back, reel him back in to make sure he stayed on point. And as you grew more comfortable with him, and as he grew more comfortable with you, you know, like I would often have to interrupt him in the middle of an answer and be like, no, PK, that's not what I asked about. I asked about this.
But you know how often I've told you that I felt as though guys would talk the way they play. Well, when you reel back a player into, you know, and redirect him, say, no, this is not what I was asking. Wasn't it a little bit like what the coach were doing with him too?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's the same kind of mindset. It's sort of stream of consciousness hockey. Like he played stream of consciousness. He played on instinct. He tried to create every opportunity he had, whether the system called for it or not. I think sometimes his teammates were frustrated by that. His coaches were definitely frustrated by that. It would have been interesting to see PK Subban play for this coach. I'd be fascinated to see what Martin St. Louis felt, how he felt about stream of consciousness PK Subban hockey. I feel he would embrace it probably, but the coaches that he had were basically the opposite of Martin St. Louis. I mean, you know, Michel Therrien on the spectrum of coaching. These two guys are at opposite ends of the philosophy spectrum, you know. So, but you know, just to get back to covering him is that there was also this sense when you worked, you know, I worked at NHL.com for the entirety of PK Subban's time in Montreal. And it was, you had this sense that you better not miss something. Like when he was talking, he had the potential to say something that would become national news. And if you missed it, you missed it. And so as a reporter, you kind of had this obligation, even though you didn't have any reason to talk to PK Subban that day. You kind of felt like, okay, I better just put my recorder in there just in case. And that's why he always had these huge scrums around him, is that even if people didn't necessarily have something that they needed to talk to him about, if they saw he was talking, I mean, I would see guys like literally just leave in the middle of an interview with someone else because they couldn't miss what PK was saying. And maybe this was kind of the source of, or one, this was one avenue that created some of the animosity, is just how much attention he attracted every time he opened his mouth. Because every time he opened his mouth, it risked being the news of the day. He risked saying something that became highly newsworthy. So I eventually learned that that's not the way to go about it. You know, like that's not. And actually, I remember once standing in a scrum, it was my left hand, and I'm standing right in front of Hal Gill, who's sitting in his locker. But the scrum was so deep that I was like basically between his legs. and I just looked down and he looked at me and I was like, I'm sorry, man. He's like, that's okay. I understand. And what was interesting about that moment is that, you know, I was barely listening. I could barely hear what PK was saying. But Hal Gill was listening just as intently to what he was saying as all the reporters were. Like, he was checking to see what how this kid handled himself, you know? And Hal Gill was, like, a really important part of PK Subban's career early on. You know, he liked PK a lot, but he also kept him in line and made sure that he behaved in a way that an NHLer should behave in his eyes. And so that moment was interesting. But I think over time, I also realized that you're not actually risking missing too much with PK. Because of what you mentioned earlier.
Well, yeah, and you're losing more as, you know, going away from a player that's taking time talking to you, answering your question, just to go listen to somebody else. You know, you damage more of your relationship with that first player than catching some sort of sensational answer that anyway is going to be recorded by so many other media.
Yeah, so yeah. Exactly. Well, no, but I mean, if you work in television, for instance, not only do you have to be in that scrum, you have to have a good camera position. So, like, people are like running.
Yeah.
I mean, it created this dynamic where people would suddenly just be running through the room to make sure they had a good spot. And so, and you know, I think that does sort of encapsulate a little bit of the PK Subban hype, as he mentioned. You know, I think it'd be worth talking a little bit about, you know, when I had a long, long, long conversation with PK Subban in 2017, not long after joining The Athletic in November. And he talked about this hype that formed around him and how that hype started to become real from his point of view and how that became problematic with not only the organization, but maybe even some of his teammates, although he was speaking specifically about management and ownership.
What do you mean about the hype getting real?
The hype around his brand, everything that he was trying to cultivate as a player and as a brand, you know, how as that was manifesting itself, as that was becoming more and more of a reality, where the phenomenon I just mentioned, that you can't miss what PK Subban has to say, like he was an entity unto himself. And this is his own perspective, like him saying that as that became true, as my vision for how my brand was going to be cultivated was happening, that became problematic. And it's just interesting hearing it from his point of view, how he resented never having that conversation with the Canadians, that the Canadians never embraced that. That they never talked to him about charitable work or philanthropy. They never talked to him about marketing possibilities, about endorsements, any of that stuff. That bugged him. And that's why, you know, I asked him at that point, I was, you know, during that conversation, I was like, you know, did you tell the Canadians about that donation? Like, why were they not there? And I knew that he had not told the Canadians about that donation, that they were caught. I remember talking to their head of PR at the time, and calling him that morning and being like, what the hell? Why didn't you give us a heads up on this? And he's like, well, because I found out at the same time you did. And so, you know, as great an event as that was, and as great an act of generosity as that was and remains to this day, how he handled it with the Canadians kind of says a lot about how that rift sort of developed. And kind of got accelerated, I think, by that very generous moment in his life.
Yeah, because to me, it's clear that over time, probably the last couple of years in Montreal, and from that point on, his own brand became the bigger preoccupation. And in a team sport, it's a slippery slope.
I think it was seen that way, but there was no evidence of that on the ice. None. I mean, there was no evidence that his own brand was taking away from his game. On the contrary, he was playing some of the best hockey of his life. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. The year before he got traded, that 2014-15 season, which is kind of what I wrote about last night. But I mean, that was PK Subban's best season of his career. Like, he was 60 points plus 21. He was third in Norris voting behind, I believe it was Carlson and Doughty. He was in that mix. He was a legit finalist and would have been a legit winner that year. He was a dominant defenseman. So there was always this notion that what he does off the ice will take away from what he does on the ice, or that he's not showing a proper commitment to the team or to his own game or to the sport. Except there was never any evidence of that in his play. You could never look at his game and say, well, he's clearly spending too much time doing X, Y, and Z. He's not devoting enough time to his game. Well, you watch him play and you're like, I don't see that. I don't know what.
Well, that's why there was such a big discrepancy between the perception from the public and how he was seen in the room, because the public look at the product on the ice and they see a guy who's jumping out there, who's highly productive, who was good enough to be traded for Shea Weber ultimately, which is not, mm-hmm. which is significant in itself. But I think that the concern that was behind closed doors was really an off the ice type of thing, where it was. So that's how it became more of a personality thing than just strictly your effectiveness as a goal, as a hockey player. Because on the ice, sure, sometimes he would be unpredictable for his own teammates, that made them uncomfortable. But there's a ton of stuff that ultimately players will forgive to their teammates if generally they feel like that teammate is on board with the whole program. And as soon as at some point, I know that there are some players who thought that he felt as though he had become bigger than the team.
Well, this is what made him so difficult to cover. Like, this is to just kind of maybe wrap it up here, because he was not easy to cover, even though he gave tons of good quotes and was actually really good at talking about hockey. Like, I loved sitting down and talking about situations, especially the situations that he got in trouble for, turnovers, mm-hmm. A bad penalty. If you waited a couple of days and asked him about it, like, he would go in depth about exactly what he was seeing, exactly what he's thinking, what his intentions were, why he did it. He was great that way. But he was difficult to cover because there was just always, it was always something going on. And there was so much stuff going on underneath the surface that was never quite blatantly obvious, but it was there. And as a reporter, you had to know it was there and you had to acknowledge it. But it went counter to everything that everyone else saw from this guy. And so where you struck a balance between this thing that you know exists, but can't really nail down because no one's willing to actually say on the record how they feel about about this situation in particular or this teammate. But you know, it's simmering. But everything that you see publicly from him, and even with us, everything you see on the ice for sure, suggests something entirely different. Suggests that this is a guy you would never trade, ever. Why would you trade this guy? Especially when he's locked in at a reasonable salary number, what we thought was a reasonable salary number at the time, and he's performing the way he's performing. How could you ever even consider moving this guy? But those other things that are there but hard to really nail down and fully identify, they were there. And you had to incorporate that, but you couldn't incorporate it too much. It was very, very tricky, tricky guy to cover. And I think it was the same thing in Nashville. The same dynamic existed. And then he got to New Jersey and he was, unfortunately, had become pretty insignificant as a player due to injuries. His body let him down. And that probably made him a lot easier to cover as a result.
Yeah. So happy retirement, PK. 33 years old. He's he's going to be, he'll have all the free time in the world to go about his million projects. He's always defined himself more as a person who plays hockey than just strictly as a hockey player. So now that he's turning the page on his career, he's got tons of stuff going on.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that his second career is probably going to be more
in front of a camera.
Well, I think it's going to be more successful and more impactful than his playing career was.
Yeah. That's fair to say. Yeah. That's fair to say. All right. So training camp starts today. In 6 days, there's going to be the first exhibition game against the New Jersey Devils. So things are going to go quickly from this point on. 74 players at training camp for the Canadiens. Roster battles for playing time. We brought it up today. Young defensemen that will be vying for spots. And we haven't brought up Samuel Montembeault and Caden Primeau will be fighting for a job too, is most likely as backup to Jake Allen. So still a lot to watch over the next few days. Arpin, thank you so much for your insight once again. We'll talk next week.
See you, everyone. Have a good week.